This is section 336, hashtag yes all women, ordain women, well-behaved women, making history and challenging patriarchy in the digital age. And I wrote out an introduction for the panel, glad I did, so that I wouldn't forget anything or get sidetracked, and also so I could speed read it so it wouldn't take much time because I really want a good chunk of time for Q&A, so here goes. The original idea for this panel was born when Doe Daughtry, who couldn't come this year, emailed me and Mary Lynn Robertson with a suggestion for a panel on what hashtag Yes All Women means in a Mormon context. I hope you've all heard about Yes All Women, which was a campaign where, in the wake of the murders in Isla Vista, California on May 23rd, women everywhere began sharing on social media their experiences of harassment and abuse from men who feel entitled to their attention and their bodies. Doe suggested that we ask as many women as possible to share their experiences of being harassed and abused in an LDS context, whether it be by date rapist return missionary boyfriends at BYU or bishops who behave inappropriately or whatever. And if you want to use the Q&A to share your experiences, please feel welcome. But one of the things I thought about was how effective that hashtag became at getting people who had previously been blind to misogyny to finally see it. It worked not because women finally hit on the perfect tone for discussing sexism, but because events in the world made people sit up and pay attention and be receptive to the mission message that was always there if they had been willing to listen. Kay was excommunicated on June 23rd, not for apostasy, but for conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church, or as Mike Quinn put it in an article by Peggy Fletcher Stack that I read the next day, bad manners. This wasn't really a surprise, given that a few days before this, LDS PR rep Allie Isom was interviewed on Radio West and kept complaining about ordained women's tone. I thought about Doe's idea for a panel and about the fact that by excommunicating Kate for not being well-behaved, the church had made her profoundly historically relevant. So I wrote an email to Mary Ellen with a subject header that is the title of this panel, and my abstract was one sentence. This panel will explore some of the reasons why the argument that women need to police their tone when discussing gender inequality is complete and utter crap. This email was after the deadline for a proposal, so whether this panel could happen depended on someone else dropping out. But someone did, so here we are. We will speak in alphabetical order. There are six of us because Troy Williams had to drop out, and because, as I said, I want to leave plenty of time for Q&A, each panelist gets 10 minutes, except for Janice, who asked for 11. And I even downloaded a timer app, and I will time you. So I'm glad we're starting with Janice because I think that she herself is a refutation to the tone argument. I'm sure that she is as capable as anyone of losing her cool and screaming, but I've never heard her do it. In conversations about Mormon doctrine and women's roles, in addition to being brilliant, she is uniformly respectful, reasoned, and reasonable. So if hitting the right tone were a decisive element in conversations about gender, Janice would be officially ordained and recognized as the high priestess she is.
The problem of tone was brought up by Allie Isom, Senior Manager of Public Affairs for the LDS Church, in an interview with Doug Fabrizio on Radio West about the church's response to impending high-profile disciplinary councils. Fabrizio was pushing Isom to give a clear definition of where ordained women had crossed the line. Why was Kate Kelly, its head, being faced with a church disciplinary council and possible excommunication? What had she done wrong? Is it wrong to question church doctrine? Is it wrong to disagree with church policies? Isom replied, "The conversation is not the problem. It is not what is being said. It is how it is being said that becomes problematic." Fabrizio followed up, "So the tone's important, the way you present it." "Very much so," said Isom. As a one-time English major, a lover of literature, and a close reader of texts, I noted these comments with particular interest. I found it fascinating that a rather subjective literary concept was being invoked to explain disciplinary action. As a person who had been excommunicated for apostasy, who has studied intensively the process and meaning of church discipline, and who is familiar with the details of many high-profile cases, I did not believe her explanation. As the conversation proceeded, I was amazed that Isom repeatedly asserted that the important thing for church members as they ask questions and express opinions, is to seek the Spirit and follow the Savior. There was no indication in her remarks that there could ever be a difference in what the church teaches, what church leaders do, and the Savior's doctrine and will. In my own case, I can state positively that I was excommunicated because I chose to put my testimony of Christ and my desire to follow him before my willingness to obey church authorities. Clearly, Isom, as a spokesperson for the church, wanted to present a positive image of the church as an organization that welcomes questions, encourages free discussion of ideas, and follows the teachings of Jesus Christ. Tone, not conversation, is the problem. In literary criticism, tone is a term used to designate the attitudes toward the subject and toward the audience implied in a literary work. Tone may also be used to describe the moods or emotions conveyed by a piece of literature. What attitudes, moods, and emotions are conveyed by the Ordain Women website and concerted actions? Ordain Women works very hard to convey a respectful tone. They present themselves as active, faithful members who recognize and respect the authority of church leaders. They believe in the power of the priesthood and desire to more fully serve in the church through ordination to priesthood offices. They respectfully ask the leaders of the church, whom they support as prophets, seers, and revelators, to pray about this matter. Like Oliver Twist, they say, "Please, sir, I want some more." And the similar ensuing commotion shows that the problem is not the tone. The problem is that they ask for more. And in asking for more, they question the perfection of the present structure and authorities. The two actions that Ordain Women carried out, requesting admittance to the church's all-male priesthood session of General Conference, offer a classic example of nonviolent resistance and how it works to expose oppressive systems. Of course, Ordain Women, in requesting permission to attend the sessions, was not openly charging the church with oppression. However, the fact that they used this method to call attention to the problem of gender inequity in the church shows an implicit recognition of the fact that there are no legitimate channels in the church to raise important issues, propose needed changes, and challenge abuses and inequities. Those who assert that Ordain Women did not go through the proper channels ignore the fact that there are no proper channels for them to discuss their grievances and petition the leaders for their rights. This is a feature of an authoritarian system. Addressing a systemic problem requires the concerted action of a group of people. If there is no way within the system for members to address systemic problems, if leaders refuse to engage in conversation with dissidents, activism is required to call public attention to the problem. In this effort, the help of the media is essential. The response of the church to these two actions showed several features of oppressive systems. The first is the refusal of the authorities to engage in honest, open discussion. Michael Otterson, the director of Church Public Affairs, expressed this stance clearly in an open letter about women's roles in the church. He wrote, "Yet there are few people with whom public affairs and general authorities do not engage, such as individuals or groups who make non-negotiable demands for doctrinal changes that the church can't possibly accept." Isom declared that Ordain Women not only has a problem with tone, but also with mood. They use the imperative mood to make a demand. But the imperative mood may be used to express desires and make requests, as well as give commands and make demands. What the church fails to acknowledge is that the women asking for ordination have no institutional power. They have no ability to make demands or coerce. The church leaders have both. The second authoritarian feature exposed is the refusal to discuss the substantive issue. By focusing on tone or inappropriate methods or angry demands, the authorities deflect attention from an open and honest discussion of the actual issues. What is the nature of priesthood? How is it connected to the gospel, to the process of salvation, to the church, to Christ? Are there any texts that explain why only men can be ordained to priesthood? Is women's exclusion from priesthood offices a doctrine or a policy? Such questions were never addressed or answered. If church authorities regard their position on priesthood as non-negotiable, why can't they explain the reasons for this position? The fact that they expect members to accept their pronouncements without question exposes their authoritarianism. Another abusive practice exposed is the labeling of dissidents as apostates and outsiders. Otterson says, no matter what the intent, such demands come across as divisive and suggestive of apostasy rather than encouraging conversation through love and inclusion. But who is doing the excluding and the labeling? Who is refusing to converse? The church uses the charge of apostasy to discredit and silence members who put forth alternative views, especially views that challenge the authority of church leaders. And this is the crucial point in exposing authoritarian systems. In an authoritarian system, all questions and issues finally rest on the question of authority. Who is in charge? Who gets to decide? I have seen the same pattern repeated time and time again. The bottom line is obedience to church authority. The pattern goes like this. A person publishes an article, delivers a speech, sets up a website, expresses an opinion, or asks for a change that in some way challenges the authority of the leaders. The local leader makes demands. Cease to write, speak, or publish on this topic. Take down your website, recant your opinion publicly. If these people refuse, then they are excommunicated on the grounds of disobedience. The charge of apostasy, teaching, or espousing incorrect doctrine is transformed to conduct unbecoming a member. Doctrine is never discussed. The conduct unbecoming a member is refusing to bow to priesthood authority that exercises unrighteous dominion by using arbitrary demands to coerce obedience. Under this system, disciplinary councils are more instruments of coercion than councils used to decide the guilt or innocence of the accused person. At my disciplinary council, I presented a long statement defending myself against the charge of apostasy, which I gave to the press and people attending the vigil. Later, a man in my ward, a lawyer who had participated in many disciplinary proceedings, said to me, "Janice, you misunderstand the purpose of a church court. It's not about establishing guilt or innocence. They won't hold a court unless they've already decided you're guilty. The purpose of the court is to get you to repent, to understand the seriousness of what you've done, to understand the consequences of refusing to repent. In other words, to coerce obedience to the demands of the leader. Obey or be punished." In the discussions surrounding the excommunication of Kate Kelly, there was much talk of leadership roulette. The idea is that local leaders vary in how they view dissent and carry out discipline, and whether or not dissenters are punished is simply a matter of what leaders' fate deals them. Of course, the church spokesmen have repeatedly affirmed that disciplinary matters are initiated and carried out solely by local leaders. But, as Doug Fabrizio asked Ali Isom, why wouldn't the general authorities get involved in high-profile cases that seriously affect the church's image and influence the way members view church doctrine and policies? Aren't they obligated to do so? And as the top level of management of a tightly controlled system, they surely do. There is good and even conclusive evidence that they have in my own case and many other high-profile cases that I am familiar with. Since they clearly have the power to get involved in these cases, and no one would question them doing so, why do they continue to lie about it? This clearly fits into the way an authoritarian system works. It uses vague guidelines for acceptable behavior, unclear definitions of apostasy, local leaders' power to make arbitrary demands, and the ability of top leaders to hide their participation in actions that might be questioned by members in order to maintain a system of coercion. The top leaders cannot be questioned because they have hidden themselves behind layers of underlings and veiled themselves with the cloak of infallibility. Certainly, local leaders vary. Some do use their power to serve their congregations, while others, desiring to rise in the corporate system, use their power coercively. Nevertheless, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve are ultimately responsible. They have created and maintained an authoritarian system of lies, ambition, and coercion, and they must answer for it. One of the clearest revelations on the nature of priesthood says that no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, but only by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness and meekness, and love unfeigned. This revelation warns that those who use priesthood power to cover their sins, to gratify their pride and ambition, or to coerce others lose that power. Those who claim to be guardians of the doctrine of the priesthood ignore this revelation and seek and use the power of coercion rather than the power of love, truth, and service. They stand at the door of the temple, dangling their priesthood keys between their legs, But neither. But neither enter nor allow others to enter the holy place. We ask for bread, and they give us a stone. We ask to minister the bread, and they stone us. How long, O Lord, will you suffer these impostors to pollute thy holy house? How long will this people continue to allow these wolves in sheep clothing to pull the wool over their eyes? They can whiten their sepulchres, polish their image, and enlarge their dominion, but their works do follow them, and the rottenness of their fruit will show their true colors.
I'm Teresa Edmonds. I'm a blogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives. And since our time is so strict on this panel, I promised Holly that I would limit my remarks to a double middle finger and a suck on this. When I started blogging at FMH, my writings were far more on the faithful end of our feminist and faithful mission. I wrote a regular column called Thoughts from Sunday School, where I shared devotionals with a feminist and progressive spin. Although you could never accuse me of being the mild voice in the room, my work and reputation showed a commitment to approachability and being non-threatening, and I spent years begging men to identify as feminists and help us in the work. Fast forward 10 years, and now my reputation is as the woman who kicks ass and chews bubblegum but is all out of bubblegum. My name regularly strikes fear in the hearts of men who identify as feminists and many who don't. Most of my current writings are about allyship and privilege, and in fact, just this week at Feminist Mormon Housewives, we released a new comment policy that is causing a fair amount of controversy, and it should not be surprising for me to say that I wrote the section with the support of my FMH co-bloggers that says that men are guests and observers in our feminist space. Thank you! So what changed in that time? What turned me from the woman who begged men to participate to the one who will now no longer brook any nonsense from them? There are two things, the founding of WAVE and the unsavory underbelly of the Bloggernacle. In 2010, a number of women from the Bloggernacle got together to create an organization that could serve as an advocacy group for our feminist concerns. This was LDS WAVE. We spent nearly a year crafting our mission and vision statements, working to communicate our goals, and doing it all in as church-friendly way as possible. We specifically made no reference to requesting the priesthood. We advocated for changes that were not only non-doctrinal, but completely supported by the current Church Handbook of Instructions. All of our board members were faithful church-attending women, and we positioned the entire effort as a retention effort to keep women going to church. Our first big effort was publishing a collection of quotes from our female auxiliary leaders. There's literally not a way we could have been more appropriate or non-threatening other than if we were called from within the church structure itself. Despite all our careful crafting, with a few successful exceptions, the response we got was hostility. Most of us board members faced consequences in our local wards. I lost my calling with the youth and was unofficially disfellowshipped. I was not allowed to speak or pray or hold any callings. Every time someone put my name in to request my service, the bishop just said no, without explanation, and just left them to wonder what exactly I had been up to. Chelsea Shields Strayer says that she faced harsher consequences for her participation in WAVE than she has for her participation in Ordained Women. And of course, in those pre-Ordained Women days, we got zero attention from anyone in the church office building. No GA meetings. No GA meetings. No board meetings. Okay. Don't take this from my time. No. We got zero attention from anyone at the church office building. No GA meetings, no board meetings, no PR meetings, utter silence. My experience with WAVE taught me personally the lie that is respectability politics. Respectability politics is a term that comes from race theory, and one I've encountered as I'm addressing my own allyship issues. In communities of color, respectability politics is the idea if you behave enough, which means act white enough, then you'll get safety, security, and possibly even access to power. This is something that is self-policed from within the community. It's Bill Cosby complaining about thuggish youngsters. It's some black people who look down on others who use African-American vernacular English when they speak. It's the older generations begging younger generations to be respectable so that they can get along. And in a world where Trayvon Martin is considered a threat, you can see the legitimate fear for safety that motivates this thinking. As a white woman, the respectability politics I face usually comes from other women, other straight, able-bodied white women, to play nice. The threat isn't safety, it's soft power. There's a very specific, narrow opportunity for women to have access to power, and many women are invested in maintaining that limited access at any cost. When I was a young women's president, I had a conflict with the young men's president over his idea for how to run the programs together. I thought his idea was going to waste a lot of time and motivation and result in a really negative experience for the youth. So I went to him to discuss changing the plans he made with the outgoing young women's president. He just told me, "The train has left the station," and refused to discuss it. I was shocked, and I immediately went to go to see the bishop, but I was stopped by a counselor in the outgoing presidency. She said, "Just let him have this. He keeps pitching it, and we all know it's gonna fail, but you don't wanna get a reputation as difficult. So just nod your head and let him fail, and then you can move on." That counselor was not wrong in some ways. As a woman who does now have a reputation as difficult, I have zero access to institutional power. I haven't had a calling in years. I would have only ever had a fraction of power before, but it was more than nothing. And that's what many women would rather have, fearing that there's never going to be a way to progress through nothing to equality. What these experiences show is that there is never a point at which you are respectable enough. There is never a point where it is appropriate for a woman, even with the woman who has the stewardship to protect the youth and stand up to the young men's president, to question the authority of a man in the church. There is never a nice enough way to say that women are unequal and we'd like to change that, even if you say it through scriptures and promise that your goal is to keep women going to church. The very act of challenging authority is all it takes to cost you your respectability. And claiming that if you only said it nicer or calmer or sweeter is just a lie meant to distract the conversation from looking behind the curtain of power. The second thing that changed me into the harridan I am today is what I earlier referred to as the seedy underbelly of the blogger knuckle. Let me start by emphasizing that I am not going to name any names or publicly shame anyone, not because I don't want to, but because I have been asked by the women who have been targeted to leave them out of it, and because I'm very tight on time. Almost exactly a year ago, I wrote a post called "Cleaning Out Our Closets." In that post, I detailed the massive sexual harassment problem that exists within progressive Mormonism. Men who hold themselves up as the ideal male feminists were, in private, making lewd comments about women's bodies, detailing what activities they'd like to get up to with these women, sending pictures of their genitalia, even engaging in inappropriate touching. Some of these inappropriate and uninvited encounters have occurred right here at Sunstone, with men propositioning women who thought they were here to present an academic paper not get trolled for a one-night stand. In that post, I bent over backwards to assure men that they were not evil. I emphasized that men who do this are not future rapists, but that they were just taught that women existed for their pleasure. I begged men to not get defensive because I had solutions. I gave lists of behaviors to avoid. I discussed cognitive behavioral therapy. I said, quote, "I really do believe that this is an example of our oft-repeated phrase, patriarchy hurts everyone." In writing about an ongoing and systemic problem of sexual harassment with dozens of different victims and perpetrators than I can personally name, the shitstorm that unleashed, that I am still dealing with daily, was about how unfair I was being to the men. It wasn't about how to help the women who had been victimized. It wasn't about how to root this problem out of our community. Commenters didn't care so much about that. They cared about the men. They cared about a potential witch hunt and false allegations and misunderstandings for men who had not been named. Their concern for anonymous men under no threat was greater than their concern for additional potential victims. Despite me protecting the identity of these men, practically telling them that it wasn't their fault, and providing solutions to the problem, I still faced wrath and censure I couldn't even comprehend. I was personally attacked and threatened, and I still regularly am, over the issue of male allies. It was discovering how widespread this harassment was that made me so aggressive on this issue. We have welcomed men into our spaces, and they have used it to abuse us. Here, I should say, hashtag not all men, but hashtag yes all women. Men have worn the feminist label while being guilty of the most flagrant harassment. That is what has made me, my co-bloggers, and many other leaders within the Mormon feminist movement step back and insist on proper ally behavior, because our trust has been broken. The next post I wrote was an introduction to ally behavior, and honestly, I thought I was writing it humorously. I made a list of 11 things men needed to know to participate in feminism, things as controversial as not touching a woman without her consent, or maybe not making rape jokes. And each item I started with saying, it's not about you. 11 times, it's not about you, which I thought was funny because things repeated over and over again are funny. It was not taken as funny. It was taken as hostile and aggressive and silencing and sexist. Despite the fact that the content was really not inappropriate or controversial, my daring to say that feminism isn't primarily about men, although I did go on to detail the times when it really is about them, was reacted to as if I wrote an entire post full of male gendered slurs. I've tried being nice, and I've tried being sweet, I've tried doing whatever it takes to be productive, and now I've reached a point where I can only echo the edited words of Amy Poehler, I don't care if you like it. After 10 years in this game, I've learned that it's rigged. So the only thing I can do is say what I mean and keep saying it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until it either sinks in or gets funny. Thank you.
Hello. My name's Kate. Kelly. I'm just really honored to sit here. As you'll see, we've got the apostate red going. We didn't plan it. It was the spirit led us all to identify ourselves through our dress. My parents are here today, I think. Yeah, they're there. Way to be awesome. And one of their favorite stories to tell about me, particularly my mom, is when I was 5 years old, I had a birthday party. And I was very particular about a lot of things when I was young. And most of the kids at the party were older kids. You know, I was 5 and they were, you know, 7 or 10, or it was different families in our ward. And I got to be in charge of the activities for the party. So I said, we're going to go on a hike. Now, I lined up all the kids 2 by 2 in a long line to go on the hike, and I stood up on something that was a little higher, and I said, all right, we're going to have some rules. And I said, the first rule is, I'm the only one who gets to make the rules. And then, that's a true story. And then I went on to elucidate all of the rules for marching on the hike. When I told my wonderful husband, who is also here, and really, really hates attention, so when I told him that story on the way up and that I was going to tell it, he said, man, you are a bossy little girl. And I said, you gotta come to the panel. Like, even you, you're an amazing feminist, and you just called me bossy. I said, think about it. Think about a time when you've ever heard a little boy called bossy. It doesn't exist. There's no time at which a similar scenario, a little boy instructing the people in the party, the other kids at the party, to do certain things would be called bossy. So I learned throughout my life, as a very assertive leadership-oriented child that I would be called bossy. And that's something that really stuck with me, that the things that were positive characteristics in my male counterparts were seen as negative in me. That's something I learned as a very, very small child, and that's the type of narrative control that I think has dominated a lot of Mormon women. And Neil is awesome, just so you guys know. he made the website Ordained Women. He's been very, very proactive and an excellent ally. But man, he still called me bossy. I think really at the heart of narrative control is power, the issue of power. The power to define unwritten, vague rules that only you can decide when they are broken. It's not explicitly stated that girls aren't allowed to be in charge. It's not explicitly stated that girls can't be at the head of a line instead of at the back of the line. These things are unwritten, they're vague, and the only people that get to decide when these rules are broken are men. Everyone who knows me knows I'm a crier, so this is not abnormal. But I think one of the most powerful lessons I learned about narrative control was when we were first starting Ordained Women, and I'm crying because the people are in the room. We were trying to decide our tone, and we were trying to set the tone and make a very open space for active, faithful Mormon women like myself. We went through a period where people were submitting profiles who were no longer members of the church. And Margaret was one of those people. And Margaret submitted a profile, and we had, and I'm not sure she knows this or the full extent of this, but we had a very vigorous debate about whether or not to allow Margaret to submit a profile. And what that taught me, and we made the right decision. in the end, we were convinced by people like Holly that we were allowing the narrative control to affect us in such a profound way that the way that the church had characterized people like Margaret, like Janice, we were buying into. We were afraid that people who were seen as combative or outsiders, who had been alienated from their own culture, we bought into that narrative, and I'm saying we because that included me. Now being on the other side of the outsidership, I'm extremely glad that Holly and others convinced us to be inclusive and to not allow the narrative control that had been exerted to affect our decisions. And I'm on the, now that I would be included in that group that would not be allowed to submit a profile to Ordained Women, I'm glad that we made the right decision. but I think that shows is just a really small insight into the ways that the tone argument affects us. It's such a paralyzing thing to be a woman and to be worried about how every single thing you're going to say is going to be perceived. It's paralyzing, it's frightening, and it's wrong. I think throughout the experience of Ordained Women, one of our most powerful tools has been our tone, and most effective. We intentionally set out to create a space for active, faithful Mormon women to be able to tell their stories, and for all Mormon people. And that has been our most effective tool. Down to, you know, we have been very thoughtful, down to the font on the website that we use, and the ways that we portray our images, because we want to take back the narrative. We want to be able to say things in the way that we want to say them. And so I think the font and from the font all the way down, we have been very, 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 very intentional about our tone. And in the end, that is what came to bite me. I think, you know, we've been saying what we really mean and feel, but we've been saying it respectfully. We've been saying it with absolute deference to the way that revelation happens in the church. And I think that that's opened up an entirely new conversation. However, we haven't been saying it in a tone, which my father identified one time we were listening to General Conference. He said, "Why is it that every time a woman is speaking, no matter what she's talking about, it sounds like she's talking about knitting?" Like, she could be talking about anything, and it sounds like she's talking about knitting. I think that ordained women has been telling the truth, but we don't sound like we're talking about knitting. We have been respectful. We have been extremely orderly. you know, one of the reporters who came to our October 5th action where we attempted to attend the priesthood session, he was from Al Jazeera. And after the whole thing was over, he's like, "Wait, that was it? Like, the internet is breaking over that? Like, you just waited in a line and then you left politely when asked to?" and I'm like, "Yep. That's it. That's what we did." And I think, again, the tone has been the most effective. In any argument, you know, I'm an attorney, and in any argument, when the opposing party or the person making a counter-argument uses the tone argument and says, "It's not what you're saying, it's the way you're saying it," that, to me, is an indication that is a swan song. That is the final swan song before they are forced to confront the substance of your argument. Ordained women is going to continue to be respectful, but we are going to continue to talk about things that are important. We're going to continue to use tools such as patriarchy bingo, which was another big controversial thing that we did. Ordained Women has a series of discussions, now called conversations, because, again, we want to be respectful of tone.
Your time's up.
My time's up. we will continue to be respectful. We will continue to follow the Spirit, but we will not be silent, and we will not moderate our tone.
Nancy. And my husband and I were married in the St. George Temple after meeting in graduate school. And I teach art history at a state university in southern Utah. And I've held a number of callings, including Relief Society teacher, pianist, and music leader, Cub Scout leader, primary and early morning seminary teacher, and activity day leader. I like to read, write, and play music with my two daughters. And I love the scriptures and all of their messiness, and I'm blogging my way through the Book of Mormon. I grew up in a difficult family, and my belief in God's love has been an important anchor throughout my life. Mormonism continues to shape my belief in God, form a significant component of my sense of community, and offers me a hope of a life of eternal learning and progression. Today, and this today was a while ago, but today, something happened that I think really highlights the need for women to both hold the priesthood and positions of real leadership in the church. My husband and I were cleaning up after dinner this evening, and he asked my opinion on something. And my five-year-old daughter asked him why he needed my advice. And why? Because he was the boss of our family. We have not taught our daughters that he is the boss of our family. She learned that recently in primary. As they were learning the song, "The Family is of God." And I explained to her that in our house, we try to make decisions together. As I was discussing this with her, I worried that the egalitarian marriage that my husband and I tried to model is minimized by the LDS Church, both in culture and in practice. And I worry that my five-year-old daughter is being taught in both direct and indirect ways that women's voices do not matter. And I want her to know that my voice matters, but ultimately, I want her to know that her voice matters. And I believe that women should be ordained. Okay, so. So I apologize for that. And it hurt my face. That was my ordained women profile. And I read it in a primary voice, as you may have picked up on. And when Holly asked me to speak on this panel, and she said that the subject was tone, the first thing I thought of was primary tone. A few months ago, not currently, but a few months ago, I was a teacher in primary, and we'd recently had a changeover of primary presidency. And our previous primary presidency were great. And they were some of my friends, and they really tried to make primary great. But the new primary presidency were reverence police, and they used primary tone in such an aggressive way that it really made me uncomfortable to be there. And that's pretty bad. You know, if the teacher can't make it through, what are the kids learning? Trying to Google primary voice, that didn't really work because primary voice turned up a lot of other things. But I was trying to come up with a term that I could search for that would really articulate what primary voice was. And there really isn't a recognized and identifiable term for primary voice, but I came across this article from Slate. Okay, and the author talks about watching the 2012 presidential campaign with her 9-year-old daughter who loved Harry Potter and quickly identified Mitt Romney as using Dolores Umbridge's voice. And this is very topical for me in my life because my 7-year-old daughter just finished Harry Potter Book 5, The Order of the Phoenix, and we watched the movie together. And so I was reminded, this is very fresh on my mind, of the voice of Dolores Umbridge. And this primary voice, which is modeled to us by female auxiliary leaders, is really the voice that women are kind of supposed to use in the church. But it's an awful voice, and it's terribly condescending and hugely obnoxious. And, oh, it's just so disgusting. Like, but this is the voice that is appropriate for women to use in a public setting, and it is a voice that you do not want to listen to. It is a voice that you do not respect, and it is a voice that you look down on and want to make fun of. And this is the model that we have for women's voices in the church. Thank you.
Oh, Hi, I'm Margaret Toscano. I was excommunicated in the year 2000 for apostasy. Being nice has never been one of my goals, but kindness has always been important to me. So the first time I was accused of being vicious, angry, and power hungry, I was somewhat surprised. The year was 1988. It was the first meeting of the Mormon Women's Forum. Kelly Frame, Karen Christ, and I had been planning our inaugural meeting for months. We wanted to create a forum to discuss gender inequality in the LDS Church. We had advertised at Sunstone. Kelly and Karen had even invited women from their wards. I had already been in trouble, so I knew better. Predictably, I spoke on women's exclusion from the priesthood and the theological and historical justifications for ordaining women. Kelly and Karen talked about other areas of gender inequality in the church. There was a great discussion afterwards from the good-sized audience where women expressed their feelings and frustrations. The meeting seemed successful, and we had plans and volunteers for future activities. So it was rather disconcerting when Karen reported later that the women from her ward had reported her apostate behavior to her bishop, and she was called in and put on probation. A couple of women even confronted her and named me as the worst part of the evening because I was so vicious and angry. This puzzled me because I had perceived myself as rational and straightforward. Passionate, yes, but certainly not vicious. I had done no name-calling or ranting. But this set me thinking, and I observed a lot about the Mormon sensitivity to tone over the last 30 years. I will boil my observations down to two major points. My first is that Mormons have a hard time dealing with conflict in general, but conflict over doctrinal and policy issues is considered the worst kind of conflict. It doesn't matter what tone of voice you use or how soft you speak. As soon as you bring up anything that is controversial in the church, you will be told that your tone is wrong and you will be accused of being angry and pushy. The better your arguments and evidence, the more quickly the discussion will shift to an issue of your wrong tone. I found this in my discussions with church leaders over the years. They might start debating with me on the doctrine of women's ordination, but as soon as my evidence and knowledge of the scriptures outmatched theirs, they would shift and tell me that my spirit was not right, that I was being contentious. Obviously, leaders don't like their knowledge challenged. It brings their competency into question. But doctrinal debates also put their authority in question in other ways. How can we be expected to accept their statements about doctrine and policy as true when they are inconsistent and change so much? And this brings me to my second point, which is really my main point. All issues about tone, attitude, spirit, and intentions in Mormonism are really about knowing your proper place in relationship to priesthood authority. The first law of the LDS Church is obedience to your priesthood leaders. What the leaders, including the Public Affairs Committee, mean by tone is subservience. They mean submission to leaders. It is about understanding proper priesthood protocol, which includes not counseling the brethren. It means that when your priesthood leaders on any level tell you not to do something, you should not do it. And if you do, you are on the road to apostasy, because apostasy is first and foremost not knowing your place within the priesthood hierarchy, which for women... So your proper place within the priesthood hierarchy, which for women is at the bottom. This is one reason why women who challenge church leaders are more likely to be disciplined quickly and harshly. No institution wants the slave class rebelling. There is nothing more disruptive. The church relies on tractable, compliant women to do countless hours of needed service. And the more public women make their discontent known, The worse their attitude is seen because women's complaints are a direct challenge to the structure and order of the church. To include women in the priesthood hierarchy in any way would shift power. And keeping their power intact is of utmost importance to the leaders of the corporate church. This is why they can recently concede that women have priesthood power and even some authority, but they will absolutely not yield on the question of offices and keys. Outward offices and keys confer the right to control all church resources and information, which is crucial for corporate power. This is why leaders say that ordained women is demanding changes in doctrine that cannot be changed. I need to add a little footnote here because I don't want to be accused of being an angry feminist who hates men. There are thousands and thousands of men in the church who do want to share power with women and who would love to see women ordained and even have superior priesthood offices. I applaud you. Now, I can also hear some of you who have participated in ordained women saying, but we haven't been demanding or complaining. We have been so very respectful. Kate even said in her interview with Doug Fabrizio that it is the fact that we've been so respectful that bothers the leaders. And I must disagree respectfully. This is what we need to understand and see very clearly. Church leaders and mainstream members honestly do not believe that those in the ordained women are respectful. They do not see you as faithful members. It doesn't matter that you were nice and never raise your voices. It doesn't matter that in our October and April actions, we walked peacefully over to Temple Square, never carried signs or shouted slogans, that we wore appropriate Sunday dresses, that we waited quietly in line, that we asked for entrance to the priesthood session, oh so politely, and never called anybody a bad name, not even Holly did. That very... oh, I'm sorry. At least... no one knew it. The very fact that we felt we had the right to ask for entrance, that we did this publicly, that we invited the press to witness this, these acts themselves are seen as signs of the utmost disrespect for priesthood authority. We had the wrong tone because we were not subservient. Asking in the way we did means we think we have the right to counsel the brethren, which is a very serious sin in their eyes. The very fact that we showed up at Temple Square in April after the leaders told us not to do that indicates to them that ordained women is an apostate group. This is why they could describe what we did as a disrespectful protest. It is absolutely crucial for us to understand this conflict of perceptions if we're going to effectively move forward with feminist activism. What appears to us as confusing doublespeak is a reflection of leaders' true beliefs. They say we can question, but we just have to use the right tone. They call us up for disciplinary councils, but then they say we are the ones who are choosing how the council proceeds. If you're a good member, you should know that you can question as long as your questioning doesn't challenge priesthood authority in any way. And if you really value your membership, you should yield to your priesthood leader's counsel. If you don't, then you are proud and think you know better than those who represent the Lord. And therefore, you are the one who has chosen the consequences, including excommunication. They are merely following the will of the Lord. In her interview with Doug Fabrizio, Ali Isom twice made reference to scriptures that describe the Savior as yielding his will to the will of the Father. This is a key point. Leaders take this as the model for the church and the whole world. The Father is on top, then Jesus, then the prophet of the church, then the presidency, another 12, in order of seniority, of course, and on down to the lowest members of the church. Each person is expected to yield their will to those above them. This is what it means to be a disciple. If you are a nice woman, You will understand this and do nothing that disturbs this order. If you do anything that challenges this as an order in any way, then you are a vicious, angry, power-hungry bitch, even if you are speaking in the sweetest tones in a low voice with your head slightly tilted. Thank you.
The first time somebody ever called me an angry, vicious, power-hungry bitch was 1978, and I was 14 years old, and it was a 22-year-old RM Sunday school teacher. So Mark Barnes, who leads the Male Ally Committee for Ordained Women, began posting quotes a couple of months ago from a book entitled The Lucifer Effect by Philip Zimbardo. It was so relevant to what was happening with ordained women that I thought, I have to read that. Zimbardo's basic argument is that when people do evil things, it's not so much that they're a bad apple, but that a bad situation requires that behavior and that people become trapped in roles. He arrives at this thesis from his work on the Stanford prison experiment in the early 1970s, where college-age men were randomly assigned to be either prisoners or guard in a makeshift prison, and within hours became those roles. He mentions an experiment in which 8 people made an appointment with different mental hospital admissions officers and complained of hearing voices or noises, but had no other unusual symptoms. Each was admitted to their local mental hospital, and as soon as they were dressed in the patient's pajamas and scuffies, they behaved in a pleasant, apparently normal fashion at all times. The big question was how soon the staff would catch on, realize they were sane, and bid them adieu. The simple answer in every one of the 8 cases in each of the 8 mental wards was never. If you are in an insane place, you must be an insane person, because sane people are not patients in insane asylums. So the situation identity reasoning went. To be released took a lot of doing after several weeks, and only with the help from colleagues and lawyers. Finally, after the suitably sane 8 were checked out, written across each of their hospital charts was the same final evaluation: patient exhibits schizophrenia in remission. So in order to, you know, if all of us, we can never again be nice women. We can only be bitches in remission. The week before her disciplinary counsel, Kate was interviewed on Radio West. Her voice cracked with emotion as she said, "I feel like if I could just sit down with one of the leaders, and if they could just see me for who I really am, and if they could engage in this conversation, not about me, but with me, as sincere, faithful Mormon women, the outcome could be very different." Of course, she was right. The situation would be very different if the leaders could see who she really is. But they can't see that. For one thing, she's not a person to them. She's merely her role, which is someone who challenges and therefore undermines their authority. In the Q&A of the Thursday session on church discipline, Amanda Hendricks-Komodo argued that when the leaders look at Kate, they see not merely Kate, but Sonia Johnson as well. Earlier this week, I read an article in the New York Times called "Powerful and Cold-Hearted." And it began by asking, can people in high positions of power, presidents, bosses, celebrities, even dominant spouses, easily empathize with those beneath them? Psychological research suggests that the answer is no. Studies have repeatedly shown that participants who are in high positions of power, or who even temporarily feel powerful, are less able to adopt the visual, cognitive, or emotional perspective of other people compared to participants who are powerless or made to feel so. And then it asks the questions of why power makes people feel cold-hearted. Some suggest that powerful people don't attend well to others because they don't need to. And the authors of this study suggested a different, albeit complementary, reason from cognitive neuroscience. On the basis of a study we recently published with the researcher Jeremy in the Journal of Experimental Psychology General, we contend that when people experience power, their brain fundamentally changes how sensitive they are to the actions of others. And it's a pretty short little article. They discuss showing people asking people to write about either feeling extremely powerful or extremely powerless, and then they showed them slides and asked and tested their mirror response. And even feeling powerful reduced people's reduced the engagement of the brain's mirror system. And one of the things I thought about when I read that was just how smart Jesus is. I'm not a Christian. The atonement kind of grosses me out. The idea that we all can't go back and live with our parent unless some of us torture and execute our big brother is distasteful to me. But nonetheless, Jesus got some really smart things right. And so when he said in Matthew 20, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and that they and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. This isn't the rule. This is a fundamental spiritual truth, in other words. And the exercise that the Pope does of washing someone's feet isn't just an exercise. And when Pope Francis chooses to wash not just the feet of 12 important men, but Muslim female prison inmates, he's affecting his ability to feel empathy. And we need leadership who do that. We need to be willing to do that ourselves. I have 4 minutes left, but I'm going to stop and just turn it over to questions and testimony bearing and any conversation you want to have. Let's rock and roll.
I just, I know that wasn't a question. Thank you, Curtis. I just wanted to chime in and say that wasn't me. I was on the wrong side of that argument. I changed my mind. Changing your mind is a powerful thing. And I just want to give Holly credit for that, actually. Because at the very beginning of Ordained Women, Holly was on a lot of the calls, and I'm like, man, that lady is mean. but she was saying things like, how dare you? How dare you exclude Margaret? How dare you exclude other people that have given so much? How dare you exclude other post-Mormons, ex-Mormons? And she was right, and I changed my mind. So.
When we say things like the Spirit doesn't give us a spirit of fear. and how there are so many things in my life that I've done that were necessary but were scary. And those feelings of fear made me feel like, maybe this is the Spirit telling me not to do it. And how Mormons, and I think especially as Mormon women, we run into that a lot. And confronting feelings of fear and feelings of contention and feelings of, you know, anything that we see as negative, overcoming that and labeling that not as the Spirit. It's not the Spirit. Labeling that as products that are flawed human condition has been something I had to do on my own because the church doesn't have language for that. And I think what you've all done is help put a label to that and say, no, actually, there are things that need changing, and the Spirit is also a voice of warning, and that's what we're doing. So I'd love some more thoughts on the tone of the Spirit and how the Spirit can sort of be sometimes a badass, like all of you. And, yeah, any thoughts you have on that?
One section I would have liked to included in my very short remarks was about the tone of anger, because I think quite often we feel that an angry tone is somehow a wrong tone. But for me, it's very helpful to understand that behind emotions are judgments, and the judgment behind anger is injustice. We get angry because there is an injustice being done. Now, sometimes we can make wrong judgments about what is just and what is unjust, and we do have to look carefully at our judgment, but anger means, basically as an emotion, anger means an injustice is being done to someone or something I care about. So then the second part of the emotion of anger is an impetus to action. I must do something to correct this injustice. And so I think when we say certain emotions are not right or not given by the Spirit, I think when this, definitely the Spirit will tell us if an injustice is being done and we should be angry.
I just wanted to add one thing to that, which there's another word for that, which is righteous indignation. And I think, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, why are you so angry? And I'm like, why are you not angry? Like, why, you know, why do you think it's okay for men to have exclusive access to all positions of power in the church? Why does that not make you angry? And so I think sometimes it's useful to flip that question around.
I wanted to add a little something to that. I find it to be just absolutely blasphemous the way that Mormons often use the Spirit as a silencing trump card.
Absolutely.
And say that the Spirit has left because you're so contentious. I am a Christian. I am like all about the Spirit. I strive to commune with the Spirit daily, hourly, by the minute. And sometimes I get sassy with God. I know, shocker. And sometimes he gets sassy back. And sometimes there's conflict in that, and there's resolution in that. And I just cannot abide this just like taking something as majestic as the Spirit of God and putting it in this tiny little box and portraying it as like this terrified little shivering like puppy dog that's like, voices are raised, I have to get out of here. You know, that to me is absolutely blasphemous.
I want to add one thing to that. I totally agree with you that it's a silencing technique. And the thing I think is so chilling about it is that it silences people both in public and private. It makes people afraid about even their private spiritual worship, and I think closes off avenues of really productive spirituality.
Okay, I know you're waiting patiently. I'm going to say one thing myself. This is the primal scream prayer I wanted to lead you all in. One of my favorite scriptures is Romans 8, 26 through 28. Likewise, the Spirit also helpeth our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought. But the Spirit itself maketh intercessions for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. And he that searcheth the hearts knoweth what is the mind of the Spirit, because he maketh intercessions for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. That's us, people. And I would like us all to have to pray in a groaning which cannot be uttered. And sometimes I think those are the truest prayers we make, the ones that are just cries of despair or rage or at the injustice. And so I'm going to put this down, and I really seriously, I want everyone to groan or scream or something. This is our art performance moment where we pray. So come on.
Okay.
Sunstone, or hard and feathered and run out on a rail if I choose to be a voice in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. So everybody, be patient, and let me talk about a different narrative. Janice led into it by saying, let's not do injustice to other people. I want to say a word in defense of the leaders of the church. They are tasked teachers, evangelists, for the perfection of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edification of the body of Christ, that we no more be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. Now, the leaders of the church are trying to fulfill that challenge, that assignment from the Lord. And yes, they will make mistakes from time to time. But we ought to give them credit, I think, for diligently trying. And when we say that they lie or they deceive, I'm afraid that is a judgment call that people can make about the leaders in the Bible. You can take almost any prophet of the Bible and call him deceitful or a liar. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that they were trying to do the work of the Lord the best way they understood, and that they realized that sometimes people will push and pressure for certain changes in the order that the Lord has established, such as the children of Israel asking for a king, and that the Lord gave in and gave it to them with certain consequences. So my final statement is, let's be charitable, let's be apply the same principles to the leaders of the church as we want to be treated. Let's do unto others as we would be done by.
Hashtag mansplaining. I just want to briefly comment that one thing that the leaders of the church did in the past, and I'm specifically thinking of Moses here, is that he listened. And he listened, and he took the concerns of the people to God. And that in my idea, that is what a prophet does, is that they take the concerns of the people to God, and they receive an answer.
All the statements I made were clearly based on evidence. And when I said they lie, I was not simply using an ad hominem attack. I was basing it on the fact that they say they are not involved in these local courts, when in fact there is conclusive evidence that they have been and continue to be. So that was a statement of fact, not an ad hominem attack. When I say that they use these councils to coerce people, that is based on solid evidence. When I remind them that the scripture, the doctrine of the priesthood, which they claim to be the guardians of, tells them not to use this power
to cover their sins, to polish their image, and this is one of the purposes of the councils, is why people can be excommunicated, because somehow they have hurt the image of the church, in which case these men are putting the image of the church, something that is dead, above the lives of people. They do this. When they coerce people, they have lost the power of the priesthood. Everything I said, I corroborated.
I want to thank David for perfectly illustrating exactly what we were talking about. He didn't, you know, we weren't nice enough. We dared to question them, therefore we are in the wrong. They deserve the benefit of the doubt to a degree that we do not. And as I stated, there is evidence that exercising power changes people's brain and reduces their ability to feel empathy. These men are biologically unable to empathize with us and unwilling to do the service that would allow them to empathize. They do not deserve our obedience or our respect. I realize that there are people, many people, including most of ordained women, who nonetheless honor the office they hold enough that they will still do so, but they do not deserve it.
I think it's important, though, that we allow someone like David to speak, because, in fact, we want to, you know, illustrate the principles that we believe in, which also, I mean, I totally am fine with what you just said, Holly, and responses. I think we have to be willing to have a real discussion, and it's hard when there is disagreement in the room. But we need to have models for how to disagree, which for me does not mean that you don't raise your voice or you don't become emotional, but that you allow others to speak. And so I'm glad we let David speak.
Really quick, I do want to say that Troy Williams was supposed to be on this panel, and he was going to represent the LGBT perspective. This is the other thing. It, as she says, it is all related, and we will not tackle the problem. We will not solve the problem unless we tackle them all together.
I just wanted to chime in that in my professional life, I'm a human rights attorney. And it's because of the abuses that I see worldwide in a lot of the cases that I do that I chose to speak out for ordained women, because a lot of women face much more dire consequences for speaking out, including arrest, beatings, rape, murder, and all of those things. So when I thought about those questions, it wasn't my inclination to say, well, our problems don't really matter. It was my question to say, how dare we? How dare we not speak up when the things that we have to risk are social consequences and not the brutal murder of our entire families?
I feel like the interconnectedness of all of these is also kind of like one through line through all of Mormondom. I feel like the torch has been passed all the way back from Emma and Eliza. And I know when we were founding WAVE, I did an interview with City Weekly where I threw off the top of my head an example of, well, how about we just get changing tables for babies in the men's bathrooms? Just as like an evidence of one tiny little change that would be like the skin off nobody's nose, but would make such a huge difference for women. And I virtually tarred and feathered. Like, the reaction to me was unbelievably hostile. And so I do agree with Anna. What she was saying is that prioritization, it is another silencing technique, because people are saying, why do you care about, you know, changing tables? Why don't you care about domestic violence? Well, of course, A, I do care deeply, and if you know my body of work, you would know I care about abuse and violence. But I think what we've seen is we could not have ordained women without WAVE because of the hostility that WAVE experienced that was then, you know, transferred onto ordained women. We can't have Yes All Women without these decades of groundwork of women slowly being able to express their truth in a safe environment. Yes All Women was this major moment, this groundswell where suddenly women felt able to express these mundane things that happen in their lives that are truly traumatic, and none of those things can happen without the respect of these tiny things. Like, why would somebody feel like, I can publicly confess the time that I was raped in a bathroom stall if I can't even ask for a changing table? Those things are absolutely all connected, and claiming otherwise is just another way to get us all to shut up. If you're not already reading Young Mormon Feminists, then look them up, because they are addressing exactly what you're talking about and doing such phenomenal work doing it.
I'm going to put in a plug for the Ordained Women Conversations, the newly named Conversations. And the first conversation is about evaluating the ways in which patriarchy has permeated our lives in both positive and negative ways, and starts out with a game called Patriarchy Bingo, which is the most depressing game you'll ever play. But it's a very useful tool. So I highly recommend those. And I also encourage you to speak up and to join us. I wasn't a 16-year-old like you. And I think it's just so inspiring to hear from younger and younger people who are thinking about these questions. So thank you.
Hang on, Nadine. I want to respond. Nadine will be our last question, and then it's lunchtime. And, of course, we'll all be around if you want to talk to us. And And I'm just hoping that you actually talk about this over lunch. I just want to say that for many of us, you are the reason that we're doing this. I don't have children, but I have nieces and I have friends. And there are so many women who say that it is the experience of looking at their children and saying, I can put up with this for myself, but I can't put up with this for my daughters and my sons. And, you know, we love you.
Awesome panel. And I don't have a question. I have a comment. And my friends at Ordained Women in Feminism are past wives and all of us have heard this before. And I'm going to preface it with hashtag, if the shoe fits. The church has done lots of complaining about all this talk of ordaining. But here is my sequel. One day, we'll be equal, and then you'll be done with mansplaining.
All right, I want to say one final thing. I'm going to read a scripture. This is Psalms 139, 14, and I was thinking about it in the middle of the night, which is why I managed to sleep through my alarm. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. We are all fearfully and wonderfully made.